Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by Katie Bors and James Forsyth. As September approaches, Remainer MPs are plotting their parliamentary assault on Boris Johnson. Katie, what's their latest plan?
So there's a lot of talk this week of a government of national unity. And this is the idea that you can talk about various archaic procedures that you could find precedents. But one clear way in their mind to stop no deal would be to bring the government down in a vote of no confidence in this case. And then there'd be 2 weeks for a new government to be formed. And then this time they would install a government of national unity. Now that'd be a government made up of a cross-party group of MPs. And I think that in the minds of lots of people suggesting this, the type of person who lead it wouldn't be someone like Jeremy Corbyn. You'd be thinking about Keir Starmer, Hilary Benn, maybe Dominic Grieve. Is that kind of ilk, I think, that we're talking about. And then what would this government achieve? Now, I think that even advocates of this plan admit that this group would probably have little in common when it came to governing in general. But what they would all agree on would be the need to stop no deal. And therefore, they would be able to almost form a letter-writing government, by which point they would send a request to extend Article 50 and prevent no deal. Now, There is a catch here, or potential catch, because Number 10, or at least the current inhabitants of Number 10, dispute that this would actually work because Boris Johnson would simply refuse to resign. So if you brought down the government, the expectation would be that Boris Johnson would then say, well, you have no confidence in me. I now quit as Prime Minister. What we believe Dominic Cummings, his senior advisor, has been telling people is if Boris Johnson actually said, well, I'm staying put, then you would not have the option for a new government to form. Instead, over that 2 weeks, Boris Johnson could try and form a new government. If he failed, he would then choose a date or have a big role in choosing the date of an early election. And I think there is a dispute over which side is right.
So what is quite clear here is that Boris Johnson isn't under any legal obligation to resign if he loses the vote of no confidence. He instead can try for 2 weeks to try and get a majority of the House to support him, and if he can't, he can then fight an election. And I think you could argue that, I mean, you can make a very credible and plausible case that given why the Commons would be no confidence in him, he would have a right to say, I'm not resigning, instead I'm going to go to the country and see if the country that voted in the referendum to leave backs my position on Brexit or the House of Commons is, the majority in the House of Commons' position on Brexit. Obviously, if he doesn't resign, there is no one to send the letter because that extension, only the government can request an extension. Parliament cannot request an extension because that treaty making is a Crown prerogative power. So he could not do, I don't see how this plan works unless you think that Boris Johnson would feel honour bound to resign. Boris Johnson would argue that he feels honour bound to deliver the referendum result, and he knows that in to his mind, resigning would lead to another extension which would not be honouring the referendum result, again, in his mind, and so essentially that means that there is a massive flaw in their plan.
Katie, just playing the Remainer game for a minute here. I mean, if Boris Johnson, let's say, does resign after he loses no confidence motion, who would lead that government? You gave a few names there. Would cross parties support really rally behind any one person?
Well, I think this is the big question, because what would Jeremy Corbyn do in that instance? And I think that the Labour front bench would be very reluctant to replace the Conservative government with a government of national unity, which didn't have Jeremy Corbyn playing
government
a central role.
Government of Remainer unity, we should say. Government of Remainer unity.
Especially if Dominic Grieve.
It would be many things, but it would not be a government of national unity.
As Labour would call it. But I think it would be, it'd be something which the opposition, I think, would have serious questions over propping up. And I think you would need those Labour votes, a government which didn't have the leader of the opposition playing a central role and stopping being leader of the opposition. So I think there's questions there. You would expect the Liberal Democrats, given their aim, to have one. But also, what does this government, and James pointed out, you know, you can call it government of Remainers, but they all have different competing aims if you actually start to break it down again. So, for example, when people talk about the various cross-party politicians they can find agreement with, or you have figures in Labour and the Conservative Party who both really detest and I think regard with suspicion the politicians on the front bench of the opposite party, but you have Labour MPs who say that Actually, David Gawke, the former Justice Secretary, and Rory Stewart, the former DFID Secretary, are both people they can find some things in common with. And likewise, you have Tory politicians who point to Yvette Cooper and Hilary Benn as Labour politicians who they can find common ground with. Now, they all have different views on Brexit. Ultimately, David Gawke and Rory Stewart want a Brexit deal of some sort. Yvette Cooper says she doesn't want no deal, hasn't yet voted for a deal, but it's not quite clear what she wants from Brexit. Then you have people like Dominic Grieve, who clearly want to remain and want to have a second referendum. So I think that even if you somehow manage to form a government briefly, if Boris Johnson resigned, if all those things, if it worked out as Dominic Grieve and others hope, I think all it would be to do would be to try and extend Article 50. There's some talk of would they revoke Article 50. I don't think there's a majority in the House of Commons for revoking. If you look at the Labour MPs who are scared already about the backlash they're going to get from constituents if they don't deliver on Brexit, do we really think those people can go from perhaps not voting for a deal, perhaps voting to extend, which many were cautious about, to just revoking Article 50 full stop? No. So I think that what you are doing is, there's lots of talk about whether an early election would now see the UK leave during the election campaign. I think this government of national unity, which we're going to call it for now, would be aimed at making sure that the, I suppose, the playing field, what happened in that campaign would be that the UK wasn't leaving, rather than coming up with a long-term solution for governing.
James, could a ploy like this backfire on these Remainer MPs insofar as it will be fueling the betrayal narrative that the establishment has never wanted to deliver Brexit? Look at the MPs trying to frustrate government again by putting in someone utterly unelected.
Yes, I mean, look, Boris Johnson is obviously a Prime Minister who is only Prime Minister because he can command the support of House of Commons. He's not Prime Minister because he has led his party to a general election victory. Mm. But I think someone who was put in by an odd cross-party alliance of MPs with the sole aim of seeking an extension to Brexit would certainly, from a large section of the electorate, have a particularly potent legitimacy problem. I also think, to come back to Katie's point, I think it's very important here, which is this coalition has lots of different interests. I was talking to one former Tory minister late last week who is very opposed to revoking Article 50 or a second referendum, but is also very opposed to no deal, right? And this is where things get tricky, because his worry is that the fact that Dominic Grieve is always out there as the person explaining their legal arguments and their procedural ruses is a mistake, because it makes them all look like they are trying to stop Brexit. When this person's view is that the only thing he wants to stop is a no-deal Brexit, and he also wants to stop a second referendum and all these other things that Dominic Grieve wants. So I think this is part of the problem here. There is a broader point here that MPs and Parliament are much better at knowing what they don't want on Brexit than what they actually do want on Brexit. I mean, that is, you know, and that problem persists to this day.
Yeah. And just to get an idea of just how difficult that coalition may be, Nicola Sturgeon, leader of the SNP today, has come out and said, if we crash out with no deal, Corbyn will be almost as responsible as May or Johnson. This doesn't sound like the words of someone who's happy to work with Corbyn, Katie.
Well, I think it's worth pointing out what she also said, which is that she hinted at a progressive alliance with Jeremy Corbyn. So you see the SNP talking tough in terms of Labour's role in, I mean, some would say, to use Tony Blair words, the handmaiden of Brexit. So I think the SNP are very critical of Labour's current position. But she did hint that she could join forces in a progressive alliance after a snap election. So you're starting to see with this current, I would say, consensus that within the 6 months there will be an election. It just depends if it's before or after the UK has left. So those are the circumstances. At the moment, all the polls suggest that no party is going to have a clear majority. Obviously, a lot can change in a campaign. So which parties can work together? And I think this is Nicola Sturgeon suggesting that her party can work with Labour, depending on what its aims are. Now, Brexit would be a key issue there. So I think that clearly they would put pressure on Labour to take a more pro-EU stance, something that they've been edging to for some time. But I think what Nicola Sturgeon is saying will probably be greeted warmly by the Conservatives, because if you look at how they might market themselves in a general election campaign, they will want to say that I don't think they will be so bold as to use the terms coalition of chaos after the past couple of years, but they will want to try and paint this idea that voting for Labour will mean that they potentially work with the SNP, and what does that mean for the union? The complication is Boris Johnson's Brexit plans clearly also have implications for the union. So I think it's harder for the Tories to make a pro-unionist argument than it was 3 years ago. But I think there is that thing which, what would the price of the SNP working with Labour be? And I think there are two things they would want from any sort of, whether it's a formal coalition agreement or confidence in supply. And I think one is they want to have an independence referendum sooner rather than later, IndyRef 2. And I think second, they want Trident moved to England. Now, if you're going with Jeremy Corbyn, you might be able to agree to just get rid of Trident entirely.
There is the problem with moving Trident to England is I think there is no port deep enough to take it. I mean, this is one of the, in the, when we think back to the last Scottish independence referendum, one of the arguments that was made behind the scenes by SNP figures about why Scotland would be allowed to carry on using the pound after independence was that there'd obviously have to be some transition because there isn't anywhere to put the Trident subs. Where they would not, where you could basically get them out without everyone seeing what they're doing, and would be safe for them to be based in the rest of the UK right now. I think the SNP point, I fear that the Tory argument might be a bit more base than the case against IndyRef 2. I think you'd see a lot of them saying in Labour, in traditionally Labour areas in the North of England that voted for Brexit, if the SNP are propping them up, where's the money going to go? All that infrastructure money is going to go to Scotland. You'll lose out, you know. And that, which is what the Tories did in 2015 very effectively in Cornwall. I'm now not going to be able to remember the name of the road, but I'm sure in the Spectator's Guide to British Beaches this summer it'll be in there. They basically kept warning that if you had a Labour government that was propped up by the SNP, this road into Cornwall, which basically needed to be duelled, would not be duelled because that would not be a priority for a Labour SNP government. That was one of their kind of squeeze messages in those southwest seats. I think you see a lot of that again, but aimed more at the north rather than the southwest. It would be kind of, you know, you won't get your metro system in Leeds because, or your tram system in Leeds because they'll be sending money to Scotland. I mean, it is not a good argument from a unionist perspective, but I think you'll hear a lot of that.
And Katie, speaking of the union, a new poll for Politics Home has put support for Scottish independence at 46% for and 43% against. So that's the largest lead, I think, since Brexit.
Yes, and I think clearly it's one of those things where people read what they want. At the moment, it's an outlier. So I think you have the SNP saying, this is proof that the opinion in Scotland has changed. We need to have an independence referendum now. And meanwhile, you have unionists saying, it's one poll, it could be wrong. And you have critics of Boris Johnson blaming it on Boris Johnson. So saying that ultimately Boris Johnson isn't popular in Scotland, at least that's what polling has suggested. That's what the heckling on when he went up there suggested. And that could have basically be triggering and pushing people. I know speaking to one SNP MP recently, they said that they believed having a prime minister like Boris Johnson would be helpful to their cause because you have people who have long time been unionists, but ultimately lots of these unionist voters probably tend to be more Labour or they're conservative, but they see themselves as centrist, and they think there's such a dislike of Boris Johnson and hard Brexit, as they would call it, that some of these voters would move over to the independence cause, and that would actually edge them over in a future referendum. Now clearly you've got to see how all these things play out, but I think that is what the SNP hope will happen.
In a way, this poll is alarming, but two causes for caution about it. One is that I think normally in a referendum, the change proposition has to be quite considerably ahead to actually win. It's the change proposition that has more trouble during the campaign. Secondly, I think the experience of this Brexit negotiation will remind people that breaking up these things is generally both complicated and not amicable. A lot of the SNP argument in 2014 was to say essentially, oh, it'll all be fine, everyone will want to work together and cooperatively in a spirit of goodwill. I think the Brexit will makes that argument harder to make. I think that is a reminder that when you break up something, people tend to be quite hard-nosed in defending their interests. And they're not primarily governed, again, contrary to the argument, by their economic interests. The other thing I would say is this is, There is an intellectual reason why the SNP have argued for independence in Europe for 20-odd years, why they became a pro-EU party, despite the fact that Scotland was, in the original referendum, the most sceptical part of the UK about the whole idea of joining the European Economic Community. That is because if an independent Scotland was going to be in the EU and the rump UK state was going to be in the EU, that solved lots of the problems. That meant that there wasn't going to be any friction on the border. That meant that there weren't going to be any of these problems because, you know, Scottish goods would still be able to be sold in the rest of the UK because they would be EU goods and therefore covered by the EU single market, etc., etc., etc. If you end up with a no-deal Brexit, all of those assurances go, and therefore the economic hit from independence becomes bigger. Now, I understand that some people in Scotland would feel that the political case had been strengthened because, you know, they had been wrenched out of Europe, cliche alert, against their will and all this stuff. But I think economically it would be a more difficult sell in those circumstances because it would be a much more dramatic thing to leave the UK and join the EU if the rest of the UK has left the European Union with no deal.
James and Katie, thanks very much. And that Beaches guy that James mentioned is in our upcoming issue of The Spectator. You can hear from Laura Freeman, Ross Clark, Charles Moore, Toby Young, Richard Madley, and many, many more on their favourite beaches in Britain. And if you want to hear more about how the Scottish Conservatives plan to fight attempts for a second independence referendum, Katie will be interviewing former Scottish Secretary David Mundell this Thursday at the Fringe by the Sea Festival near Edinburgh. Just go to www.fringebythesea.com. Thanks for listening and join us again tomorrow.